Okay, in this lesson, I'm going to be walking you through this first sample deal discussion transcript, which is for a sell-side divestiture transactions I have listed right here. Now, keep in mind a couple things. First off, that even though this is for a divestiture specifically, it doesn't necessarily have to be for a divestiture. Many of the strategies that we're going to see here and many of the points that the interviewee raises could easily be applied to any other type of sell-side M&A transaction. The other important thing to note here is that even though this is for a sell-side M&A deal, many of the points here could also be applied to a number of different deals. Capital raises, an IPO, a secondary offering, debt raises perhaps. So keep that in mind as well, that you're not exclusively limited to M&A deals when you're discussing transaction experience in interviews. I do think that when push comes to shove and you have to make a choice about what you want to talk about, if you actually have M&A deals or even quasi M&A deals that did not really result in anything happening, but you still made some progress, you researched buyers or sellers or other criteria like that, it's better to talk about that most of the time than to talk about IPOs or to talk about even debt related deals. And the reason is that generally M&A deals tend to have more modeling involved. You have more quantitative work you can talk about versus IPOs, for example, where there's really not too much aside from the valuation that you do, but most of the work that you do is relating to the S1 if you're in the US or the appropriate registration statement for the company if you're elsewhere, and to conducting customer due diligence. So there is some good qualitative stuff you can talk about, but generally, if you're interviewing for private equity or for other banking jobs, they're testing your modeling skills and your quantitative abilities. So it's usually better to bias your discussions toward M&A deals if at all possible. And the way I think you should think about discussing any type of transaction like this is to think about the who, why, how, and what. So to kind of think like a reporter here and focus on these key criteria. The when and the where could also be appropriate in many cases, although I think when all is said and done, the who, why, how, and what part of it is probably more important. When and where can be significant if the market is especially volatile at a certain point in time, or if it's especially hot or cold, or something major is going on in the market. Or if you're in a region of the world that's especially significant. So, if you're talking about a deal that was taking place in some region and then a regional conflict or civil war or something like that broke out, then when and where become highly relevant. But most of the time, you want to be thinking about the who, why, how, and what when you're thinking about how to present these deals. And I think the best way to think about this is to kind of pretend that you're a storyteller, as I say here. And with any kind of story, you want to have an introduction, rising action, a climax, and then a conclusion. Now, there's more to a story than that, but those are kind of the basic parts and the way that I would think about it. Now, looking at your resume and the experience that you had, what you want to do is figure out the best two or three deals to talk about, and then go through them, figure out what your introduction is going to be. Now, usually for sell side deals, whether it's an M&A deal or an IPO or anything else like that that involves you selling the company to other people, the introduction is going to be very simple. It's going to be a brief description of the company, their financials, how they're doing, what they're looking to do. Then you want to get into the rising action part of the story, which is why they were looking to do something and the process that they were going to use to do it. Now, in an IPO, for example, this is relatively straightforward. The process is they want to raise money to expand or to buy another company or to pay back investors or whatever the case may be. And the process is that they go out, find the most appropriate institutional investors, and then raise funds from them. For an M&A deal, this gets to be more diverse because you have a choice over which types of investors specifically you want to go out to. So maybe you only approach strategic buyers, maybe you only approach financial sponsors. And so there gets to be more variety with that. You can talk more about the fit with the different buyers. And so there's more that comes into play like that. Now, once you've kind of described that, then you want to get into the crux of the deal. So what did the deal really come down to? And most of the time with M&A deals, there's usually one or two major issues that everything revolves around. In the case of major M&A deals, often it's simply price. There's a big disagreement over price, and the buyer and seller can't come to terms. Sometimes there's more to that. Sometimes with energy deals, for example, one big issue is regulatory issues. So when KKR was buying TXU, for example, for 45 billion years ago, one of the big issues that came up, it was a TXU is a major Texas utilities company. One of the major issues that came up was that all these environmentalists were protesting because KKR wanted to build a bunch of new power plants and they didn't want to have anything to do with it. And so there was a giant regulatory mess with the state legislators and getting involved and with environmental activists getting involved and all these other parties. So that was a major issue in that deal. And so if you were an analyst working on it, a lot of your work might come down to what the deal looks like if those power plants don't actually get built, and that's the major issue for your deal. Now, most of the time with deals, there's a major issue like that to talk about. If you don't have something like that, then I would try to make lemonade out of lemons and just go into what you can talk about and either talk about the valuation and how maybe the company was in an unusual situation or something else like that, or maybe the issue was that the market was just too bad, and so that was the crux issue. That was really what prevented anything from happening or made it difficult for anything to happen. So you have to kind of stretch in a lot of cases and really think hard about what the major issue was that was either going to enable the deal to happen or to prevent it from happening. And if you don't have something like that, then just use your spin tactics and just talk about the issue that you know the best or that's going to impress them the most. In a lot of cases, that comes down to valuation or modeling, if that was what was involved with your deal. And then finally, at the end, once you've been through the rising action and then the climax, you want to get into what the conclusion of the deal was. And in a lot of cases, this is you don't know, especially if you are an intern. A lot of times, it's simply impossible to know. But if you're working full-time, it's better to talk about what the actual conclusion was. If a deal didn't happen, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. You should just say that it was delayed, even if it fell apart, unless it was very public. So Microsoft Yahoo in 2008 falling apart, that would be very public. You can't lie about something like that. But if it's a lesser known deal where it was never publicly announced, nothing was ever publicly known, just pretend it's still happening. Just say, oh, we don't know yet. It's still progressing. We're in final stages of the discussion. And just leave it like that. It sounds better to say it's still in progress versus admitting that the deal fell apart. So that's how I would think about structuring your deal experience. I'm just giving this preamble, this introduction, before we actually get into this transcript, because there was no overview video for this course, because I felt it was better to just jump into the transaction discussions right here. So that's just kind of how to think about it overall and the planning that I would do when you're thinking about how to present what's on your resume and how to talk about in interviews with investment banks, private equity firms, hedge funds. So let's go into this transcript now. The first thing to note here is that this transcript, the audio clip for it, only runs for about 10 minutes, which is accurate. In most interviews, if they're 30 minutes, they're not going to spend 30 minutes talking about one transaction. More common to spend maybe 10 minutes, 15 minutes on one transaction, then to move on to another, or to talk about different topics altogether. In this case, the interviewee here worked at a local boutique, and the interviewer asked him to discuss one of the deals listed on his resume. It's important to note here that this is actually what happens in interviews. In many cases, they'll just say, tell me about one of the deals listed on your resume. And the interviewee here chooses to talk about a sell side M&A deal. Again, my recommendation is to always talk about M&A deals or restructuring deals if you have them versus other types. And within M&A deals, it's better usually to talk about sell side deals rather than buy side deals, simply because you usually do more quantitative work for sell side deals, although there are exceptions. So that's how I would try to make the selection process. Divestitures are good, restructuring, distressed deals are good. Any type of deal with an unusual outcome or an unusual process, something that you don't see all the time, is better to talk about than a plain vanilla type of deal where you're not really doing too much unique, you're not doing too much different from any other type of deal that you would normally see. And in this case, nothing has been announced yet, so he's being careful to avoid giving specific names or dollar amounts. This is an important point. I've gotten a lot of questions on what to do if you can't talk about the buyer and seller and their names. Short answer is it's fine. It doesn't really matter. Just describe their industry, describe how big they were. If you're really paranoid, then keep it very, very general. And instead of saying they were an accounting firm, say they were a professional services firm. Instead of saying they're a software company, just say they're a technology company. Or just say they were a technology, media, and telecom company, if you want to be even more general. So be as general as possible. If the size of the company makes it obvious who it is, then I would just try to make it even more vague so they really can't tell. Or use possibly slightly different numbers so they really can't tell. Now, here he gives a description of the company. Big Four accounting firm wanted to divest a division of itself that sold litigation and forensic services. And then he gives the size here. 300 million revenue, 50 million EBITDA, growing 10-15% each year with margins in the 10-15% range as well. This is a good overview for the company. I've gotten a lot of questions about how to kind of present this and start the discussion. I would do it something like this. Talk about generally what industry they're in. In this case, it was a divestiture, so there's really two companies, the parent company and then the division they wanted to sell. But talk about it like this. Give a one sentence description. Tell the revenue of the company, the EBITDA. Obviously, EBITDA does not apply for all industries. So maybe you use EBITDAR or maybe you use the EPS for the company if it's a financial institution, for example. And maybe instead of revenue, you give the assets under management or the net assets of the company if it's a financial institution, for example. But pick the relevant metric based on your industry. In this case, since it's a services slash software company, revenue and EBITDA are the commonly used metrics. growing 10 to 15% each year. Good to give some indication of this, just so they know what size the company was and how quickly it was growing. Now, this next part here about going through a shift from services to web-based software, not completely necessary to name this, but if you have a situation like this where the business model is undergoing a fundamental shift, again, I would give a one-sentence description here in the beginning so that you can frame your discussion so the interviewer has a better idea of what's going on here. Now, the next question that comes up is why they want to sell this, because it seems like this division is doing pretty well, $300 million revenue, growing 10 to 15%, which is pretty good for a mature company like a Big Four accounting firm, even if it's just one division of that firm. So the next question that comes up is why do they want to do this? What's their motivation for selling? It's important to address this in any kind of deal discussion. You don't need to say it upfront, and I actually recommend not saying everything upfront simply so you have more to talk about and so you're not rambling on for 5 minutes here. But it's really important that you address this. Common reasons that you want to sell, what you see listed here, that the business had expanded beyond the services focus, the accounting firm, it was not in their core area of expertise anymore because they're getting into software, they had a lot of regulatory issues. These are very common reasons for wanting to sell, that the division was beyond their core focus, their core area of expertise, they had a lot of regulatory issues. And then here we see another very common reason to sell, inbound interest from other companies. And they were giving very attractive potential purchase prices. These are all common reasons to sell. Other reasons might be that maybe the PE firm has decided that it wants to sell, and maybe the market's doing really well, maybe the market's hot. When Google bought YouTube, that was the primary reason, that the market was just on fire. Anything web-related, Web 2.0 related, social media related was just very hot at the time. And so that's what created a market where YouTube creating this bidding war, and they had all these other companies trying to get them as well. Now, if you're working on an IPO or a debt raise or something like that, then instead of saying something like this exactly, you probably want to say something more like they were trying to raise funds for a specific purpose. So maybe expanding, buying a new company, buying another company, getting a new factory, making some kind of CapEx investment, something like that, expanding their business into a different area. Name something like that if you're working on more of a financing type deal rather than an M&A deal, and you should be fine. But it's important to always have in mind their rationale for wanting to do this. So it's really important to know why they wanted to raise capital, buy another company, sell part of themselves, regardless of what it was. If you don't know this, then the interviewer is going to assume that you were not that involved with the deal. So it's really important to have a good grasp over this. And then here, the interviewer starts getting into the process now. So this is starting to get into the rising action of the story that the interviewer is telling. It starts out here by talking about the process being pretty broad, over 50 firms, both strategic and financial. So strategic buyers would be other Big Four accounting firms, software firms, anything that's a real normal company. Financial sponsors, financial buyers would be private equity firms, hedge funds, anyone else that makes investments into these types of companies and buys divisions of companies and then spins them off into real standalone companies. And then here he mentions exactly this. Private equity firms specialize in divestitures, which is true. A lot of PE firms do actually specialize in divestitures and turning divisions into strong standalone companies. And then here he mentions the types of strategic buyers, the technology and legal companies. So if you're working on a sell side M&A deal, it's important to mention the number of firms, whether or not they were strategic and financial, and then within strategic and financial, what types they were. You don't need to go into a ton of detail here, but the level of detail the interviewee gives here is just about perfect, where he gives maybe one or two sentences describing this. For a buy side M&A deal, we'll get into that in the second transcript, and you'll see exactly what to do there. But for a debt raise or an IPO, then the process description here is different because you're not going out to specific buyers. The process in this case would have more to do with your writing of the investor memorandum or the S-1 registration statement, the issues that went into that, and the key issues that you had to present there and your discussion of how to present them. You would talk about customer due diligence here. And instead of talking about the process going out to investors, you talk the pro talk about the process speaking with customers of the company's main customers, and what they said, the feedback they gave you, and how that affected the S-1 and how that affected the marketing of the offering, whether it was an equity offering or a debt offering. Then here, the interviewer gets into now the major selling points of this software division. Now, even though, again, this is for a divestiture, you need to talk about the major selling points of the company, regardless of whether it's a sell side M&A deal or a debt or equity financing as well. Then here, the pitch was focused on the changing business profile and how they would have higher margin revenue, recurring revenue model because they had subscription software now. And then he talks about the market and how there are a lot of incidents of Sarbanes-Oxley and how they need to. This Sarbanes-Oxley is referring to legislation that's passed in the U.S. about the controls of the company, the internal accounting and auditing controls, and how after Enron and all these other scandals, there's a lot more of this, and companies were placing a lot of emphasis on this, and it was incurring a huge cost to many of these companies. And then the management team here. So these are all good points to raise. The attractive profile going forward. Anything you can say about the finances of the company? Maybe they're growing really fast. They had really high margins. They were in an untapped market and they dominated in that market. The management team, this one's a little more questionable to talk about here, simply because it's very difficult to quantitatively say with any certainty why the management team was so good. Now, if there's an exception, if you have someone famous, let's say coming in to run the company and the interviewer would recognize the person, then talking about the management team would have a little more credibility. Here, the interviewee gets away with it, but it's not really the best thing to mention. I would probably try to avoid mentioning this and lean toward other things instead, but it's not really a mistake. It's just something to be aware of. Again, if you're working on an equity deal or a debt deal, you can talk about pretty much the same exact types of things here. You can reference specific customers you've spoken with and things that they've told you about how good it was to work with the company, or about how they've told a lot of other customers about the company. They get a lot of referral business. So there are a number of different things you can talk about here, but you generally want to focus on either the finances of the company, how it's going to be attractive in future years because of investments they're making now. You talk about the market, favorable market trends, products, customers, the management team. Those are all good points to raise here. Then he gets into weaknesses. Now, again, even in an equity deal or a debt deal, you're still going to have to talk about weaknesses for the company. For the financial sponsors here, this one is unique to selling this division to financial sponsors, but there's the issue of setting up infrastructure and administration because it was operating as its own entity. So clearly, it's not going to have the resources of the parent company anymore, which means that the expense profile is going to be higher, and so they're going to have to model that separately and look at that separately. For the strategic buyers, they're more concerned about making this transition. And you could see how, with a lot of the more conservative buyers, they might be skeptical over whether or not this company could really transition from a services-based company to a real software company. We see here for over 10 years it was all services-based, so naturally, strategic buyers are going to be skeptical over this. And then finally, many of the company's customers were in financial services, so in light of all this recent market turmoil, in light of everything that was going on, if they were going through a depression or financial crisis at the time, there might be concern over how well the company would actually be doing then, given that so many of its customers are concentrated in one area. These are all good weaknesses to list. Again, weaknesses, you can go back to a couple different areas. Financials are always a point of contention, whether or not the company really believes the projections, whether or not buyers actually believe the projections. The market is always a concern. Is it going to be worse going forward, better going forward? Are oil prices going to stay high? Commodity prices, are they going to stay high? Energy companies are very sensitive to those types of things. The company's customers all being concentrated in one vertical, like financial services, that's another common weakness for a company going forward like this. So these are all good things to talk about. Customers, market, financials, those are probably the best things to name here in terms of the potential weaknesses for any type of company, whether it's an equity deal, a debt deal, or a sell-side M&A deal like this. Then he gets into this discussion of the process. This is more of the rising action. Now, here, the interviewee talks about how they got interest from about 10 potential buyers and then narrowed down the list based on purchase price. And then they had a strategic buyer and a financial sponsor who were both willing to pay about $400 million. And they had pluses and minuses. The strategic was more likely to stick to the price, but the financial sponsor could move more quickly. Then we see here asset purchase agreements. Asset purchase agreements, because this is a divestiture, so they're not going to use a stock purchase here. The transaction structure is going to be an asset purchase because they're only acquiring one division, which means they're only acquiring certain assets from the Big Four accounting firm here. So this is a pretty good description for a sell-side M&A deal like this. For a debt raise or an IPO, then you talk about the roadshow for an IPO specifically, and talk about the types of investors you went to, the concerns they raised, the reaction, and then finally the indications of interest they gave and what the deal ultimately priced at based on their feedback. For a debt deal, it's a little more hands-off because you're usually not as involved with the actual process of raising debt for the company and going out and marketing the offering. So in that case, you'd have to talk more about your process communicating with the leverage finance team at your bank and what they told you the company could raise in terms of debt, the concerns they had over them being able to raise that much debt. So those are the types of process issues you talk about in the case of a debt deal like that. So then we get into this next part, which kind of continues the rising action here. And then the interviewer asks about who ultimately came out the winner. And here the interviewee gets into a very important portion, which is the unique aspect of the deal. He talks about how the strategic got really hung up on the IP issues, and he did some research on it, on some of the questionable or controversial patents here, and then how the financial sponsor was concerned about how they would operate as a standalone entity and whether or not the expense structure would be dramatically different. Obviously, it's going to be higher if they're operating as a standalone entity. The question is how much higher? And second question is, how is this going to affect the purchase price? This is a major issue with divestiture transactions like this. So this is important to note because any type of deal, I don't care whether it's a buy-side deal or a sell-side deal or an equity raise or a debt raise or a restructuring type deal, is always going to have some type of key issue like this that the company has to be concerned with. Now, in an M&A deal like this, usually the key issue, the crux issue, emerges near the end of the process when you're negotiating and trying to lock down the final purchase agreement and get all those details ironed out. Sometimes it can occur earlier on, but usually you want to focus on something like this, something about the negotiation between the buyer and seller when you're talking about the crux issue in a deal. Now, for an equity raise or a debt raise, usually the crux issue will come out when you're talking to customers or when you're creating the memo in the first place and you're communicating with a leveraged finance team and trying to figure out how much debt they can raise. When you're thinking about the crux issue to present in a discussion like this, you want to think about how it affected the deal, is it going to have a major impact, and then also how it affected the work that you did and your own contribution. I get a lot of questions on what you can talk about if the deal was standard or if you didn't do that much. The answer is don't worry about it. Just focus on your own contribution, what you actually did. And if the crux issue is actually linked to some work you did, that's really good. You should definitely talk about it as the interviewee goes on to do here. But it's not essential. You just want to be thinking about this because, again, you want to be thinking about your discussion of any deal in terms of a story. A story has a beginning, an introduction, rising action, a climax, and then resolution at the end. This crux issue is basically the climax most of the time. And so that's why, in a lot of discussions in investment banking and private equity interviews, you're going to be very focused on the crux issue, whatever it is. So when you're looking through your resume and figuring out which deals you're going to present, it's really important to figure out what this crux issue is going to be exactly. Now, the interviewer continues with it here, and then they get into this discussion about how they created this different expense model, what the interviewee did here, and found that the PE firm was really conservative, the expenses were around 10% lower than what they suggested. And then they get into this discussion of the bottoms-up expense model that the interviewee made here. He went through and started with the basics, employee salaries, bonus payments, option expenses, and then added in 15% overhead for this new infrastructure that they needed. He researched the cost of office locations, so there's a lot of detail here. To be honest, most of the time in investment banking, you don't even go into this much detail because it's well beyond the scope of what you do, but sometimes it does happen. In this case, there was this level of detail involved. And then finally, the cost of hiring a management team. So in this case, the person goes into a fair amount of detail on the actual models that they created for this. Again, I get a lot of questions on how to present any kind of modeling work that you did. If it's a standalone operating model, this is exactly how you want to talk about it. Now, if you're working on a leveraged buyout, let's say, then in that case, you'd go into more detail on the tranches of debt, for example, that were involved. If you were working on something that was more of a traditional merger between two companies, then maybe you talk about the exchange ratio, or maybe you talk about the synergy calculations and how you arrived at the revenue synergy and expense synergy numbers. If you're talking about something that was more of a pure valuation scenario, then you go into the tricky parts of the valuation. Was it difficult to pick the public company comparables? Was it difficult to find good transaction comparables? Was a DCF or a dividend discount model difficult for certain reasons? So you always want to look at what you did in terms of valuation work, modeling work, the deal process itself, and figure out what was unique, what was different, and what made it different from these plain vanilla deals that you see all the time. And then you want to focus on that when you get to the climax of your story, the crux of the deal, what really had the biggest impact on everything. Now, you might be wondering what you do if you worked on an equity or debt deal and you didn't have any crux issue like this. In that case, don't worry about it. If you really have nothing to talk about, don't worry about it too much. But I would say you still want to go through and think about it and think about the key issue. With debt, for example, often the covenants can be a key issue. Can a company really maintain a coverage ratio above a certain amount? Can it really maintain a leverage ratio under a certain amount? So those can be the key issues in a lot of cases. So you can sort of frame that as the crux issue, even if it wasn't really. You still want to be thinking about the key issue for any deal that you've worked on like that. For equity deals, it gets a little bit more difficult because usually it's more qualitative in nature, but talk about any feedback you received from customer due diligence calls, for example, and use that for your example of what the key issue in the deal was. And then finally here, we just get into more of the scenario, what was going on, and he talks about here how the PE firm thought that they were being too conservative, and they were willing to settle with them and agree to an EBITDA number that was around 5% higher. So it actually affected the purchase price quite a bit, because obviously a PE firm is going to be buying the company based on the EBITDA multiple. And then the strategic here was stalled. The PE firm was still moving forward. Here at the end of the deal, it was still up in the air, he says, and they were in final negotiations. Nothing has been announced yet. A couple important points here. So when you get to the conclusion, as this interviewee did here, you don't actually need to have a real conclusion. In this case, the deal could have fallen apart. If the deal fell apart, unless it was very public, then I think it's still better to say that it was still up in the air and that they were in final negotiations. I think it's dangerous to say that it fell apart completely, because it might leave the interviewer with the impression that you are not going to come back to this and you're not going to really get the deal experience of having closed a real deal. So it's usually better to say it's still up in the air if it hasn't closed yet. Absolutely not essential to have real closed deals on your resume to work in private equity, for example. It's helpful, but you don't need it. You need to have good experience actually doing modeling and technical work, but you don't need to actually have closed deals on your resume. So if something just never got out to market for equity or debt deals, rather than saying that it fell apart, just say that it's still ongoing and that there's some legal issue that's preventing you from going out right now, but everything will be set right soon and you're on track to have a successful offering. So always pretend that it's up in the air, unless it was very public that it got delayed or that it fell apart or that investors backed out in the last minute. So that's a quick overview of how to talk about a sell-side M&A deal like this. Hopefully you have a better idea now of how to structure your story when you're talking about deals like this, and also in particular how to talk about sell-side M&A deals, the key issues with sell-side deals, with divestitures. And as I was going through, I also walked you through examples of how to modify this when you're talking about IPOs, debt deals, secondary offerings, for example. So hopefully you have a better idea of how to do that as well. Coming up in the next sample deal discussion transcript, we're going to be getting into a buy-side M&A deal. And I'm going to be walking you through that, and you'll see how the language is different, how the person describes the deal a little differently, and some of the key points to be aware of, and how to impress the interviewer to the fullest extent possible without exaggerating or without overstepping your bounds.